Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. God's love isn't about favoritism, but character. Looking at Joseph, Jeremiah, and Messiah Yeshua, Christ Jesus in this study, we saw how telling truth and maintaining integrity matters to heaven more than comfort. Biblical heroes weren't perfect, but they were faithful, willing to walk through difficult paths with self-discipline. Their stories aren't just historical. They're spiritual blueprints showing how God works through people who are committed to righteousness, even when it costs everything.
Genesis 37 starts out, of course, that Jacob himself settling the land. So keep in mind that this is obviously contrasting a few details as the patriarchs progress their way in life. Isaac, as well as Abraham, were sojourners. They would travel around. They were nomadic more so than Jacob by a significant amount. And so Jacob, unlike Isaac and Abraham, who are called sojourners, Jacob was actually, he's used a different word. They're actually settling in the land where his father used to sojourn. So it starts out, this chapter starting out, to contrast the nature of the different types of lifestyle. We're shifting from a more nomadic lifestyle into a more settled lifestyle. Well, settled lifestyle, those of you who live in cities, because you all do, most part, and live in civilized nations, civilized countries, there are rules. To be a civilized nation, there are rules you follow. There are things we interact with man to man, as of course, obviously our Bible has man to God as well. So there are things which we follow in our walk in order to be a civilized nation. And one of the important things we do follow is we don't murder each other. I know, it's shocking, isn't it? That's one thing we're not supposed to do. We also don't kidnap each other. We don't sell each other in slavery. All these things which we don't do, and yet these are things that his brothers, in this case, Joseph's brothers, attempt to do. So we're contrasting this shift from a nomadic culture into a more civilized culture, which implies there's laws to follow. Not just the laws of hospitality, things that we're familiar with Abraham. These are laws that, in order to enter the people, we have expectation of behavior from one person to the other. It's a back and forth. It's a give and take cycle. So our chapter starts that transition, starts discussing that transition. Now, Jacob, of course, lived that lifestyle while he was in Laban's house for 20 plus years. So there, it's not like it's shocking or strange for him or his culture. They're no longer nomadic. But we're contrasting that in that shift from nomadic to civilized. How we treat people matters. We also, obviously, the previous chapter discussed Esau. So there, Esau had to leave. He was more nomadic, had to leave the area of Jacob's territory, as the previous chapter had listed, because there wasn't enough room for Esau's stuff and Jacob/Isaac, because they combined together, their stuff. So Esau had left. Not that that was wrong. It was fine. So Esau leaves. He still remains a little bit nomadic for a number of years before he becomes more settled in his territory of Mount Seir. But either way, they're still shifting this cycle. So as we shift cycles, we go from nomadic to settled or civilized society. There's relationships that matter, and relationships from person to person is one thing. Relationships to person or parent to child is another relationship to discuss. So these chapters, Genesis 37, as well as Jeremiah 38, and a little bit Matthew, but more Genesis and Jeremiah, they're focused more about relationship of child. That's who we're really discussing. So this type of relationship of how children are treated and how parents and relationships work. So to jump into this, so Genesis, jump into Genesis 30, verse 3, we're into verse 3 first, because that's where we are. Introductory, you know, issues start beginning. Says, Israel, referring to Jacob, Israel loved Joseph more than his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors. We'll pause there for a minute. Those of you who have children, or those of you who have been children and had siblings, imagine for a moment that your parents, or you yourself, if you're the parent, and your children, and you select one of your children that you love more than the other ones do. You don't love the others as much as the one child you do love. Now, we and our modern day culture as parents would say, that's absurd. We don't do that. You would never treat one child you love them more than a child. That's that's a wrong behavior. It destroys the relationship between parent and child, and it puts siblings against each other. That is ridiculous. We would never do such a thing, at least so we say. Now, before we sit there and criticize this task or this thing that Jacob did to his sons, and we say, well, that was a bad parenting example. We don't do that. We're love should be equally distributed. Blah blah blah. All those things we try to fix or make it sound better than it actually was. This event, this favoritism being played here, the other siblings are going to naturally be resentful. It's not a surprise to be resentful, to resent your one sibling that is not a desired or desirable experience, right? You the sibling that you hate or you're upset because mom and dad loved him or her more than they loved you. Sibling rivalries, all those bad emotions get stirred up with this. Now, before we jump in to start criticizing Jacob as his bad parenting skills, we're going to ask ourselves, okay, let's discuss where some of this comes from. Okay, what does this mean to love one child more than the other children? What does that mean? It's just that, oh, I love you, I hate you, I love you, I hate you. It's not a love and hate. It's who do you love more versus other ones? And what does that look like in a biblical text? So before we criticize them all, let's discuss a little bit. So those of you who remember Rebecca and Isaac, they had twin boys. There was Jacob, and of course there was Esau, right? Two boys. Which one of those did Rebecca love more? Jacob. It's explicitly stated so. She loved Jacob, but did she not have two boys? Yes. Which one did Isaac love more? Esau. It's like, oh, but no buts. The Bible does not make apologies for human beings. It just tells you what it is. This is what it is, how people act. Whether you like it or not, makes you feel good or feel bad, doesn't matter. So this is what it is. So people do, this is who they are. So we have a comparison here. We have Rebecca loving, obviously, Jacob far more than Esau, and vice versa, Isaac loving Esau more than Jacob. So Jacob grows up in a culture or group that this is not abnormal behavior, to love one child more than the other one. And so, well, it hurts us in our sensibilities today, but it still doesn't make it not true. It still is what it is. So we ask ourselves, well, what was the incentive that, and so discussing Rebecca temporarily here, we'll go back to just 37 in a minute. What was the driving force behind Rebecca loving Jacob more versus Isaac loving Esau more? Do you recall what the type of personality or type of events that appealed to Rebecca that Jacob characterized? It says he dwelt in tents, right? Before that's the situation. So essentially, he was more, I guess you choose the word civilized, or I guess more culturally knit together in his community than Esau was. Isaac loved Esau because he's a hunter. He went out and was provided for himself and went off in the hills, the countryside, whatever, depended upon nobody. There are two different things that each parent idealized the lifestyle that the child that they related to was mimicking. So Jacob mimicked the lifestyle that Rebecca idealized, and Rebecca loved him more. She related more to him. It was more relatable. It was more a compatible relationship as far as how they communicate with each other. Same thing with Isaac as well as with Esau. They had a better relationship with each other. They related more. Now, I'm not saying that Isaac was a hunter like Esau was. I don't even know that much about Isaac and his hunting skills. The point is, that's the relationship. So when they say loved one child more than the other, it doesn't mean they didn't love the other one. They still love the other one. But they related better to one versus the other. It's a better relation, a better connection, a better tie-in to that one child. So again, these are just the nature of parenting. That's not the only scenario. So God himself actually was a little bit more explicit. He specifies he loves Jacob and he hates Esau. Okay. He was a little bit more forceful about his love versus hate. So even our own creator has a love one child more than I love the other child. Why is that? We're going to explore why that is. That's our conversation today, is we'll be exploring why that is. This sounds dangerous. Yeah, I'm sure it does. So the nature we're exploring, what is the driving force behind one parent or a parent loving or relating more to one child versus another child? It's not they don't love the child necessarily, but what is the driving force behind it? What is God explaining or showing us through the patriarchs, through, obviously, in the case of Jeremiah, we'll discuss that as well, and of course, the Messiah himself. As is not shocking for those of you who are aware of this, God really loved Messiah, Jesus, right? Did he love Jesus more than me? Technically, yes, he did. I know God so loved the world, he gave us over. I'm not saying he didn't love the world. I'm saying he loved Jesus more than us. How do I know that? How many people die and God cracks the heavens to do it when he's upset? I don't know about you. I don't know about you, but I've never seen God crack the heaven open when someone dies other than him. Okay. There's something I've really liked about that guy more so than everybody else I've seen die. So there is some relation God has, likes him more, was more distraught, more upset, more disappointed, whatever, fill in the word, about Jesus's death compared to other deaths. And how many of us have heard God come down or a voice from heaven saying, I love this kid more than anybody except for Jesus. Well, guess what? Nobody else that we know of. So God clearly has declared his opinion about this message better. We'll discuss this a little bit because it's important to understand what the driving force is. It's not that it's a arbitrary, I feel this versus I feel that. There's actually specific reasons why parents or why God would relate to one more than the other of a child or scenario. So we prepare these different details as far as what God's doing. So there's a few things before we get too deep in our verses. We'll get there in a minute. I feel as I go through this. So behavior typically is a primary drive that humans use to relate to the humans. It's our behavior. I don't tend to hang out with people who are whoring around doing drugs and murderers. I know it's so tempting, yeah, but they're so friendly. No, I don't hang around them, okay? It's not my thing, okay? So their behaviors are not relatable to me. Just isn't. I know it's shocking, really. But so there are certain behaviors we hang around and others we don't hang around because we can relate to and work better with some more so than others. That's how humans tend to, that's how we're formed societies, family groups, we work with, that's how we find our spouses, right? Who can relate to? So when it comes to God, God is not that different from us in that system. We're made in his image. We're made in his same likeness, same concept, same principles. So there are people who we've known through history, Cain is a good example, who have done things that God said, I cannot tolerate this behavior. You need to leave. And Cain leaves. It happens. When Noah comes along with a great big flood, right? God's saying, all these people, I cannot tolerate your behavior. You need to leave because you die. But that's your leaving process is death. So there are certain behaviors God tolerates and can handle and can work with. And clearly some behaviors he cannot, right? You understand that concept. It's not too shocking. So when God says, I like this person, I think this person has good behavior or I can work well with this individual. I love them more. I like them more. I relate better with them. What does he typically do? Well, in the case we have the book of Hebrews recorded, he chastises. Yeah, what? God corrects those he loves. Yeah, you can do better. You can improve with this. Not that he doesn't love everybody in their own way. The point is, those he cares the most about, he tries to help them improve. How many of us would not like to have our children or even ourselves improve our life? Either our choices in life, our choices that they choose to make, anything happens. Well, oh, you did this, but if you just did this a little better, it would so much better. It would turn out. It for my own personal life happens all the time. So I like to improve on my own life, my own existence. So I chastise myself for the exact same principle that I want to improve where I am. I can better relate to God that way and to people that way. So these are not terribly strange concepts, but I'm setting the stage here as we jump through or we're going to go into our book of Genesis here. So we also have, of course, obviously the Messiah himself is exactly a prime example. A God loved him more than the rest of mankind. We know that much, but look what he went through. Look what he went through. I want God to love me and all. I want to love God, but I don't want to go through that. Sorry. That's a little much. Yeah. I love you, God. I want God to love me, but I don't want to live what that man went through. I'm just declaring out loud that's a lot. So in that fact, he shows kindness and love to everyone. And yet that's how he was treated, right? A brutal, slow, miserable death. public humiliation and hated by so many people. So it's not that because God loves you, therefore nothing bad happens to you. That's not the nature of God's love. God loves you, but then now you have some struggles you have to work through. And as our scriptures point out quite clearly, Jesus learned by his trials to be obedient and follow God. Those trials accomplished that. Even though he was showing love and kind to everybody, that doesn't matter. That's good. God loved him. God says, hey, I love this one more than anybody else. But what he went through was very difficult. So now we have that picture. Now let's go back to Joseph and Jacob. All right. Jacob loved Joseph more than his other sons. So what was Joseph going to go through more than his other sons? More ridicule, more difficult, hardness, those types of corrections that Joseph was going to live through and experience far more than his brothers did. Did any of his brothers go through the same experience Joseph did? No, not at all. Some went through bad things, but none of them went through as bad as he did. Now, Judah's probably the closest one that went through things that were difficult, but even then was not what Joseph went through. So we're going to discuss a little bit about these things and learn about them. So Genesis 37, going back, so we have this, our stage is set. We have our people, our characters, understand what's going on in this chapter. Sorry. 37. Yeah. So in the case of jump down to verse 4. So the brothers saw the chorus, their father loved him more than the other brothers, and they hated him. They couldn't speak any peaceableness to him. So I'll give credit to his brothers. At least they were honest. I hate you. I can't talk to you. They weren't going to lie to him, say, I love you so much, brother. No, they were, I hate you. Just how it is. Okay. I'll give them credit. They were honest, even though they were just terrible, but at least being honest. Now Joseph not being liked, you would think he had the ability to realize I probably shouldn't disclose these dreams that they already hate me about and make them hate me more. You'd think he would, but he's only 17. So he's a teenager. Teenagers do dumb stuff all the time. Okay. So it's kind of how it is. So he's a teenager. And we'll discuss a little about that because it wasn't actually dumb. But I'm just using that tongue in cheek for the fun of it. So Joseph, of course, discloses in a dream. This is verse 5. He told his brothers they hated him even more. He said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were building, binding sheaves in the field. Behold, my sheaf rose, stood upright. Indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. They said to him, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? They hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Pause there for a minute. So we're going to set aside the youthful possible non-wisdom Joseph may have had in this process, because I think there's actually a reason why Joseph needed to explain or spell out this dream. All right. It's not because he wanted more ridicule. I don't think Joseph was looking for ridicule. But he had a reason to disclose it. It's obvious for our benefit, so we could read. But a prophet gets a piece of information from God. What's his job or her job? You better spit it out. You better share it. That's the job. That's your task. Because if you don't, what happens? Bad things happen to you. And whatever he just said, God said, is going to happen anyway. But bad things happen to you if you fail to do your job. That's important. I don't necessarily know that Joseph saw himself necessarily as a prophet per se. He may have seen himself that way. I don't know. But that's where he's going through. So in this, obviously, he does it again in the case of the stars and the sun and moon and stars bowing down to him as well. But I also believe that the ridicule Joseph received, now I'll give credit to the Seventh-day Adventist Church for pointing this out to me. So kudos to them, because I didn't notice, didn't pay attention to it before. I'm sure not the ones who invented it or thought of it, but they're the ones who I first heard it from. So I'll give credit to them. Seventh-day Adventist Church did a good job with this, in my opinion, because they disclosed it to me the first time. In that this process is actually a learning experience for Joseph. He's going to learn what reaction people are going to give to him. So when God gives you a message, you have a few responsibilities. Sometimes there's obviously discretion to learn about that you have to spit it out, but also who you spit it out to and when matters also. It's not just a spit out, blurt out, vomit information any random time. There's actually a purpose behind information given to you. So, for example, we have the story of, not that we read it today, but Daniel with Nebuchadnezzar, his dreams, all the various things he was envisioning in his dream. He had a couple of them. And Daniel kind of explained the one with the statue. He also explained it with the big tree and all the stuff that was going on inside of Daniel's vision stories. But Daniel was not disclosing all these details to Timbuktu Harry living out in, you know, Walla Walla, Washington. Okay. That wasn't Daniel's job. What was Daniel? Who received the dream? The king did. So what did Daniel do with it? Explained it to the king. Now the king then did some really dumb stuff with it. He made the big long tall gold statue. He's bowed to it. All those other things he did too. Okay, he wasn't the smartest king. But the point is, it was disclosed to the king. And so the information is for the king. It wasn't disclosed every Tom, Dick, and Harry. That wasn't the objective of it. So when it comes to God revealing a message, it's not just the message itself. Who is the message for? Pay attention to that. If God gives you a piece of information, says, hey, I am giving this to you, what is the information for? What's the purpose of it? What do I do with it? I could just vomit it out and tell everybody else about it, but that may not be what the objective is. And possibly preparation. So Joseph learns, I see a church point this out to me, Joseph learned from this experience as a child that when Pharaoh's dreams come along, they don't just spit out the whole country. There's a big massive famine coming in 7 years. Everybody prepare. He didn't do that. He says, no, Pharaoh, the dream is given to you. You can do something about it. You be subtle and start expending these costs to buy these 20% of everything, whatever it is, as he's accumulating. Pharaoh, this is your job. You can do something about it. All the rest of the people don't need to know everything. It's not necessary for them. They can't think about it anyway. You know, freak them out for nothing. They'll be upset, angry, whatever. The end is near, you know, with their bells and, you know, throwing rocks at you, whatever it is. And they're not going to pay attention. So the point is, dreams and messages are not necessary for every human being to hear. They have a purpose behind them. So in the case of the baker and the cupbearer thing, they have their own respective dreams, right? And Joseph, of course, discloses that to them, their meanings. It's not necessarily that the one dreamer, what I guess the cupbearer, I think it is, needed to hear the storyline about the baker. Now, he did. He didn't need to hear the baker's storyline that he dies. So clearly, whatever was going on, the reasons why he died, only the baker knows. But that's what happened to that storyline. So the point being that there are messages for people for a reason. So in this case of Joseph and his sheaves, I don't know if his brothers needed to hear it or not. I have no idea. But I do know that these things do get fulfilled. The Joseph's brothers, before his dad shows up, do bow down to him. Now they don't realize they're bowing down to him, but they do bow down to him. So this dream does come filled, and Joseph remembers the dream. Hey, this actually happened. All my brothers bowed down to me. So it's important to understand that these dreams were for Joseph to see. Yes, Joy, hold on a minute. Right. Also that it's from God. That was part of the dream, the whole process. Right. When it happened. Yeah. So she says that she's pointing out that it was all a message from God for you. So you can see it in your life, the whole process that was going to happen. It was foretold it would happen, and you can watch it fulfill. So clearly it was for Joseph. The brothers see it later, not the time, they see it later. What happened? When it occurred, the brothers didn't see it till much later than that. It does, you see it completed, it does impact you that God had planned this entire orchestrated the entire thing for you. All the little subtle details, it was an orchestrated thing for you. Now later, of course, his father also bows down to Joseph as well when he is on or near his deathbed. So these are not shocking things, but these storylines, he gives us this long detail, but what he's telling has consequences that Joseph learns. Now we learn from the book of Galatians, I shouldn't learn, this is not, we all know this anyway, but book of Galatians, Paul points out in Galatians 4 that telling the truth can lead to generating or creating an enemy. Can only totally do that. And why does telling the truth, or why can it tell the truth, why does telling the truth generate enemies? Usually the truth telling is not necessarily pleasant the individual hearing it. It might be, but it isn't always. The truth hurts. The same principle. So he pointed out Galatians 4 is, hey, just because Paul's saying, just because I'm telling you the truth and now I'm your enemy, now you hate me because I'm telling you the truth. That's a human reaction. It's not from God. That's a flesh reaction. the whole principle of shoot the messenger, not the message. But well, that's not helpful. We have the kings that just do that. A few of them do that with inside the Book of Kings and Chronicles about they kill the prophet who gave the message, thinking that will stop the message. Does that actually stop the message? No, it is to stop God. So it doesn't matter how many prophets you kill, you can't kill the messenger and make the message go away. So truth is still a truthful event. You have to accept the fact it is truthful. We disclose it being truthful and being disclosed, our reactions do matter in that disclosure. Just because we're seeing it or hearing it doesn't give us the right to be angry or upset about the truth being, I mean, it does make us upset. But is that necessarily useful to be upset about the truth being disclosed to us? So in verse 10, so obviously we have a similar type of scenario about the sun and the stars and bowing down to him as well. And Jacob interprets this dream in verse 10, discussing that his father says, "What dream is this you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I, your brothers indeed, come bow down to you, the earth before you?" Now, of course, as Jacob kept this story, this matter in mind, he recorrected Joseph saying, "Hey, you're being, you know, basically an ornery, you know, kid that's being high and mighty and thinking yourself greater than us. It's illogical or irrational to think your mother's going to bow down to you. She's dead. Do dead people bow?" No, they don't. Dead people don't bow. They're dead. But Jacob is interpreting the moon being the bomb. Now, logically, you'd say that's absurd. Can't happen, didn't happen, wouldn't happen, never happened, sort of. Now, if you interpret Joseph's mother that Jacob's talking about being Rachel, yes, she's dead, absolutely. But Bilhah appears to still be alive, Zilpah is still alive, and Leah is still alive. So just because his biological mother is dead does not necessarily mean the rest of them are dead too. When Joseph is young, Benjamin's born, of course, Rachel dies. Who takes care of Benjamin? He's a baby. Has to get nursed. Guess what? Well, Bilhah probably did. She's the nursemaid. That was her job. That's her task. There was a hired hand to do that. She's also one of the mothers. So it doesn't necessarily have to mean that it's interpreted as Rachel alone. What's that? A lot of mothers, yes, a lot of mothers. Joseph's saying, that's a lot of mothers app. You're right, it would be. So, and I don't know the relationship between the mothers and all the kids. Doesn't disclose that. Mother one, mother two, mother three. They have names. Got a mother four. No, I mean three. No, that was number two. Crud. Which mother said what? Yes, I argue with the mothers. Yeah, that'd be funny. But anyway, so it could be interpretation. Now, by the time that Jacob bows down to Joseph, all those women are dead. They're all buried and gone. So we don't know when or how that prophecy that Jacob interpreted got fulfilled. I don't have a record of it. It just somehow, maybe it did at earlier. It's really hard to say when that took place. But so in this process, either way, so he has these dreams and Joseph is learning, of course, he's being rebuked not only by his brothers who are upset about the sheaves, Rupa, his own father, is upset about the whole sun, moon, star thing bowing down. So he's being rebuked multiple times that not necessarily every dream essentially is shared for everybody for every purpose, but his father keeps it in mind. Now we have this storyline, which is an interesting event that leads up to Joseph's incarceration and then sale. So it continues on. This is an interesting a topic because this is where it's going to start tying in a little bit, or tying more so into Jesus' story as well as Jeremiah's story. So Joseph's told to go check on his brothers, right? See how they're doing, get a report. Now, for those of you who are familiar with this concept, I would say it's disclosed all fully, but kind of understand this. When bad things happen to you, to people, sometimes, we get kind of an inkling, an intuition, a false that something doesn't quite feel right or seem right. It doesn't happen to everybody. Not always. I'm not saying it's always, but sometimes it does happen. It is commonly interpreted by both Judaism and Christianity that that's what was happening with Joseph, with the man who met him in Shechem and told your brothers were in Dothan. So read that account because so both religions argue very similarly on this event. I'll explain why. His brother went to Shechem. So Israel says, Joseph, this is verse 13. Are your brothers not feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I'll send you them. So he went down and said, here I am. Please go, see it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks. Bring back word to me. Send him out of the valley of from Hebron to the way to Shechem. A certain man found him and there asked him, saying, what are you seeking? So he said, I am seeking my brethren. He's what feed the field. So my brothers, please tell me where they are feeding the flocks. The man said, they had departed from here, for I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found him at Dothan. Of course, that's when we have the scene far off and such. So bad things start happening there. So in Judaism, as well as Christianity, commentators have discussed this matter quite in depth about a lot of books, not books, but sections of books talked about this topic, because it ties so closely into Jesus for Christianity. This intervention, this individual who's trying to intervene and trying to stop the event. So in Jewish view, which I think is a fair interpretation, because Christianity happens to agree with this philosophy, that this individual was an inkling or intervening character. Now, Judaism thinks it was an angel. That could be, I don't know. It's possible. I don't say who. The man doesn't have a disclosure of his identity. Saying, hey, your brothers are not here in Shechem. They're in Dothan. Now, we would think, so, in the next town. Was an opportunity for Joseph to go back to his dad. I couldn't find him. They weren't there. I was wandering the field for a while. Couldn't find it. I hung around. They're somewhere else. Go back home. Tell your dad they've moved on to another location. Totally could have, would have been totally excusable and definable. But Joseph's personality was persistent. I'm going to do the task given to me regardless of how much effort it takes. And God knew that. So this individual, the reason why it's bringing it up this way, because Dothan. Dothan means forceful laws. That's what the word means. Dot, which means law, and Dothan, which means force, enforced or a harsh interpretation or harsh reading or harsh understanding of law. That's where Christianity jumps on. Says, wait a minute. This is a plot to kill it, right? And it's an inkling or a symbol, an event for Messiah's life too. What was Sanhedrin trying to do? Using law to kill him. So it's a foreshadowing of a future event, because the Dothan means that. That was the idea behind it. So I don't know if Joseph realized that's what the word Dothan means, but that's okay. He doesn't have to realize everything. But that's what it is. So in Judaism, they look at this, say clearly the brothers were looking for this Jewish interpretation, a legal means, justification, to kill their brother. That's the idea behind it. And of course, Christianity jumped on that bandwagon and said, absolutely. Messiah, similarly, a legal means to kill their brother, as well as for Jeremiah. They wanted a legal means that the men who arrested him, throw him in prison, and throw them in the pit, a legal means of legal justification to kill a man. They was not justified in doing so. But of course, that was the idea. So, but Joseph's character would not allow that. He was too persistent, too good a person. Say, I'm going to quit. I'll just go home. He wasn't going to do that. Did Messiah have an inkling he was going to die? Yes, quite clearly he had inkling to die. Did Messiah have the opportunity to avoid it? Yes, many, 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 many opportunities to avoid it by turn cheek, go the other way, and run, right? Just say no, right? So the opportunity is there. It's the nature of the character of the man. What was Joseph? What was Messiah? What was Jeremiah? Did Jeremiah have the opportunity to avoid all the hellhole he went through? Absolutely. But God said, they're not going to kill you, just make your life, you wish you were dead, but they're not going to actually kill you. In Jeremiah's case. But as he had the opportunity to say no, but the men's character said, no, I know what's right. I'm diligent. I have the self-discipline to carry this out regardless of the outcome. That's the type of character God saw or sees we see in Joseph, in Messiah, and in Jeremiah. So I ask you, why were they loved so much? What type of character are they? What experience did they go through? What type of lifestyle? What is God going to put them through? And they're still diligent enough to say, I'm going to do it anyway. Most of us turn tail and run, to be honest with you. That's a little much, God. If I saw this ahead of time, you know what? Be a farmer looks good. go be a farmer. Do something else that's not involved in any of this stuff because it's really hard. Well, that same principle still applies. So these men have the opportunity to flee, but their character does not make them flee. They know what the right thing is, and they do it anyway, in spite of the consequences, because it's right. And that's what makes a character very unique, very strong, very likable, or very, in other words, very lovable to our creator. The character that says, yeah, this is hard. Yes, this is difficult. I'm doing it anyway. That's the character we're talking about. That's the character these three men have in common. And actually, a few others do as well, but inside our Bibles. We have people that says, okay, this is a hard thing. Look at Abraham. Yeah. God says, go kill your son. Oh, sure. Okay. No. Isn't that sure? Okay. Woohoo. Let's have a party. It was a miserable experience. It's the characters. Okay. This is extraordinarily hard, but I have the self-discipline and control and know I trust my God. I'm going to pull this off. I'm going to do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. Those characters, that's the character trait we're looking at. And that's what God seemed to say. I really like that. Contrast that to Esau, who God said hated. What was Esau's character flaws? There were a few. Yeah, traded everything for a soup. I'm really hungry. I could eat, or I go to my tent and cook. It's only right over there. I can trade my birthright for this bowl of soup now, or have to wait the extra 20 minutes to go eat over there. I'd rather do it right now. See how little value he gave to things that were of importance, right? It didn't trust or believe God, didn't care. God had any value, it wasn't his interest. So we have a character of contrast. So contrast Jacob to Esau. They're very different characters, aren't they? Esau, hey, that girl looks pretty. I'll marry her. She looks pretty too. Oh, mom don't like her. Okay, I'll marry. Oh, we're all three of them, right? Is there a self-discipline, self-control involved in Esau's life? No, there's not. And when he got upset with his dad and Jacob, once dad dies, I'm going to kill Jacob. Is that self-control? Well, it's a little self-control. He's going to wait till his dad died, but there's not a lot of self-control there as far as like, hey, I'm plotting the death of my brother. Now, similarly to the brothers of Joseph, they plotted his death initially. Of course, Reuben tried to save him and such, and they sold him. What self-discipline, self-control did they express? Very little. Very, very, very little. Was God loving and happy? In fact, this is wonderful, boys. Good job. No, it was not. Because they have no sense of right and wrong, willing to carry through the right and wrong, even though it's difficult. Their sense of self-discipline, I'm doing the right thing anyway, was non-existent. Now, I'll give credit to Reuben. He said, hey, let's put in a pit. I'll save him later, blah, blah, blah. Had a plan. Clearly, Reuben was relatively weak. That's quite obvious. He didn't say, no, I'm going to take him and carry him now. We'll just hide him in the pit for now, and I'm going to sneakily do it later. Right. Reuben was not a very strong leader. Right? Contrast to Judah. Was he a strong leader? Yeah, whatever Judah said, they did. That's a strong leader. Well, let's kill him. Oh no, let's sell him. Whatever Judah said, they did. So these men had the ability to be strong. Obviously, Reuben didn't anymore. He lost that for other reasons. But Judah had the ability, but they weren't, their character wasn't there. So was God saying, I really love Judah and I hate everybody else? No. Did God say, I really love Reuben, I hate everybody else? No. Joseph was a favorite son for a reason, because he was willing to do the hard thing, even though it was potentially to his own detriment. That's the character I want to bring out to you. That's an important concept to me in my belief system, in my argument. Now, I have a few things I want to bring up to you in this interaction between the sons. Oh, there it is. The brothers, not sons. Sorry, brothers. So we have a few characters showing up here. We obviously have Joseph. I'm going to let just a few of the boys. Judah and Reuben. So these are three characters I want to focus a little bit of attention, just a little bit of attention on these characters. Now, because I believe Joseph is a messianic figure, I believe his lifestyle, things he went through, was going to be repeated in some way to Messiah in some capacity. Maybe not exactly verbatim, letter for letter, word for word, but events or common things would happen and they'd be similar in their nature. So in this case, who was arguing to get rid of amongst these two, Judah and Reuben? They're the ones who actually talked. We have the top, they don't say who's talking. Who wanted to get rid of Joseph? It wasn't Reuben. Who was it? Well, it's Judah and the other guys. So with Judah, well, Judah plus, you know, what, 10? 10 others, or that 9? It's not, whatever. They're not, because Benjamin wasn't there. So we'll say 9 others. 9 others want to get rid of him. Now, that's, they were going to use whatever means, the leader, Judas the leader. I have plan. I have an idea. They opted not kill him, which is good. But they opted to sell him instead. And we have one guy who's coming to his defense. Granted, it wasn't a great defense. It didn't work very well. Actually, it failed. But he tried. I'll give him credit to it. So in the case of Messiah, this isn't that different. So in the case of Yeshua, at his trial and leading up to his trial, there are a few things took place. What was Sanhedrin doing? Which represented the tribe of Judah, by the way, at the time. So Sanhedrin, I'll put San because I don't want to spell the word Hedron. So San said, hey, let's kill him. We'll use the law to do it. Now, mind you, where was Judah brothers at? They're at the city of Dothan, which is force laws. So that's where the town they're hanging out. They're making the decisions. They're essentially making judgment at this town, which is totally legit. Sanhedrin also chooses to use the law. There's only a few people that actually did anything to try to resist that, right? There was one man, Nicodemus. Now, he was not during the trial itself, but leading up to the trial. So Nicodemus tried to defend. I'll call him Nick because I don't spell Nicodemus very well. So Nick tried to defend. Was Nicodemus' defense successful? No. But did he try? Yes. So he wasn't a bad man, was he? He tried. He was too weak to succeed. Reuben was too weak to succeed. In my opinion, I think some of these characters God was watching or observing or paying attention to during Joseph's trial and experience, God made sure some of them show up again. Now, in the case of Judah, what did he do? He sold him to who? Ishmaelites and Midianites. So Judah, all these guys got rid of him. They won and they had foreigners, F-O-R-I-E. I can't spell foreign. How do I spell foreign? The foreigners are the ones who did it. In the case of Jesus, who killed him? Romans. Foreigners killed him. So in my opinion, I think they're not that these are perfect examples, but there's some similarities to these characters that they're taking place here. So bring this up that I don't think these characters, and even their arguments they're discussing with inside their bantering back and forth, I don't think those are arbitrary. Yeah, I'm sure they're bantering discussion, but think God's paying attention to them and also recording it. And one of the things I find also really fascinating is that these boys obviously have to lie about what happened, right? They're lying to their dad. Hey, you know, here's a blood-stained, you know, cloak, whatever. So to lie to it. Now we already know because we read the Bible, Proverbs that says a false witness will not go unpunished. That's Proverbs 19. So these boys who all lie, they have to go punish. God has to successfully punish them. And the interesting thing that I think when they do get punished, because it does happen, they all get punished, by the way, in case you're not aware of that. When they get punished, when they're bowing to Joseph and Joseph is going to throw one of them in prison, Joseph and Simeon eventually, and the other brothers are arguing back and forth, it's we're guilty, we're being held because of the blood of Joseph. They're realizing punishment's back upon them. That this is how they're being repaid. So punishment does happen. Joseph didn't actually technically die, so they didn't get murdered for or killed for it. But the point is, punishment does happen. So when you go through this process and you lie about it, God is not ignoring your lie. Yeah, it may take, you know, 15, 8 to 20 years, whatever it is, later for it to actually take place. 20 years. Before the punishment does correct, but it's happened. Now, not only that, but Judah's punished beforehand. So Judah, which you'll read later on, the next chapter, you have Tamar and Judah's three sons, two of which die. So put two and put an X across it. And then one lives. And of course, he has twin boys later with Tamar. Now, this case, Judah loses two sons, just like Jacob lost a son. He loses a son. And on top of that, Judah is publicly humiliated with Tamar, right? He says, she's cheating on him. Burn her to the stake. They get all out. Oh, here's the guy that I said, oh, it was me. Oops. Okay, everybody. She's fine. Let her go. I said, really, Judah? What happened? I don't want to talk about it. she's more righteous than I am. Just leave it that. The point is that that's public humiliation, isn't it? What's the one thing people hate the most is humiliation, embarrassment, shame. It is, we will die first to avoid that. Like public speaking is number two on the list, or number one list on fear versus death. We'd rather die first in public humiliation. It's scary. We hate that. So Judah said, okay, God, say, hey, Judah, you tried to conceal this and make it, you know, all nice and neat and neat package. It's so well thought out, Judah, but you know, I'm going to expose as you possibly could be. Public humiliation is not the pleasant experience. So Judah gets that public humiliation earlier, than his brothers do when they all have to go back and tell the dad, Joseph's still alive, says, you're lying. No, he is. Yeah. Okay. Explain yourselves, boys. And who's going to say what happened? Maybe Judah did. I don't know. Somebody volunteered. Yeah, that's what we've been doing, Dad, for the past 20 years. Yeah. Again, humiliation. Now, the one person that you don't want to, because they were trying to avoid their fathers, trying to tell the father the truth, and all the lie gets exposed. The point is that lies will catch you some way, in some capacity. The lie itself may or may not come true, or may come out to be exposed. But some capacity, you don't go unpunished because of it. There's still punishment. So in the case of the Sanhedrin with Messiah, it's not that different. Those men themselves probably themselves may have lived a while, but the entire Sanhedrin, everything is wiped out in 30 years or 40 years. It's about 40 years later. So they're all gone because the sacking of Jerusalem, they're all dispersed and they lose their power to everything. So they're all humiliated that as well. So the Sanhedrin, I can't see the specific individuals. I'm not sure who was there at the time. But they get their own exposure of their defeated lie. So it all comes back in some capacity or another, maybe not the way we like, but it does happen. So even the case of Reuben, I'm just, the next element here to point out to you, in the case of Reuben, what time is it? Oh, I'm almost out of time here. In the case of Reuben, he's distraught when he finds out Joseph's missing, right? The pit, he's out there. What's going to happen? Oh no, oh no, oh no. He's upset. He says, what's going to happen to me? So Reuben turns around and what's going to happen to me now? That's Reuben's reaction. These bad things happen. This is verse 26. That he is. Reuben's upset. The brothers, however, are all at peace. They dumped him in the pit and they're all having a party, eating, relaxed, no qualms, upset. We're patting themselves on the back. Look how great we are. Look, we're so smart. Reuben's one says, who's distraught? What do I do now? Where are we going to go? Reuben's upset, bad things happened to him. Now, they didn't necessarily, but he's upset. Messiah's disciples were also upset. The exact same reason. They were fear. They were afraid. So in John 20, discusses it when Jesus dies, and now the disciples all hide and they locked into the room because they're afraid that Jesus would kill them too. So the fear, even Reuben's fear, though it was very self-centered, even his fear was still duplicated by the Messiah's disciples, who were his friends, who were his defenders. He was a sort of defender loosely. They were his friends. They were trying to work with him. They were afraid too. What would happen to them next? They're next to the chopping block. Something bad things would happen. So even the emotional reactions are still duplicated in somewhat what happens here. Let's jump very briefly to Jeremiah 38, because I've eaten up so much of my time on this one. So Jeremiah 38 discusses a few details how with Jeremiah. Now Jeremiah, for background a little bit, he's been, you know, prophesying and such. Jeremiah 37, he was transferred from out the public, telling people, y'all should surrender to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. He was transferred to the dungeon temporarily. It says many days. That could have been months. I don't know how long it was. In the dungeon for a while, the king Zechariah pulled him out and talked to him briefly. So Jeremiah goes from the dungeon, so a pit, which is one form of pit, so the dungeon, Anyway, he goes to a dungeon, which is a prison essentially, and he goes from a dungeon to the guardhouse. The guard is like a guard courtyard, a place where the guards are at. They're the closest to the king's space, and he continues on his declaration. What's going on in the guard space? Well, a bunch of princes, not princes as a form of the people who are heir to the throne, princes, leaders of their divisions, their tribes, or their groups, all right? They get the opportunity to hear what Jeremiah is saying. And they go to the king, says, I don't think so. So they go to the king and says, hey, king, we're going to kill him. Now, much like Reuben, the king is too weak to say no. But that's interesting. So we have a weak king here at this time period, and the princes all know it. So it's not shocking the fact they have this scenario, but the point is that the princes are these chieftains or these advisors, people who are in charge of stuff. The king, they go, king, we're going to kill him. We're going to kill him. The king says, I can't tell you no. I have no power to resist you on this. I can't force you to defend him. Nothing at all. The king is too weak to do that. So the king says, do what you want to do. What am I going to say? I can't stop you. So the chorus, they don't immediately kill him. They want to torture him a miserable death by dumping him in a cesspool pit. So he's in this pit, a long shaft pit. I'll put little Jeremiah down here, my stick figure Jeremiah. And there's muck and whatever else he's hanging out inside there. And there's guards up top. And they're probably laughing. I don't know what they're doing. They're doing something. So the point is that this is pit he's hanging out in here. Now, a pit is typically symbolic, of course, of a grave, because this will be Jeremiah's grave otherwise. Now, obviously, Joseph was thrown in a pit too. Similar concept. That's why these are tied together. In the case of Jeremiah, there's the one character, the Ethiopian, who's from obviously Ethiopia. He says to the king, hey, this is wrong because we're not feeding him. Now, Jeremiah has been allowed to hang out in the guardhouse or guard territory, and he was given some bread and it could talk openly there because they wanted him away from the common people. They want the common people to be freaked out. Well, Jeremiah's telling the guards, go surrender, go surrender, go surrender, go surrender, go surrender, go surrender. Is that really like make you feel strong and defensive? Oh yeah, well, we're going to win. Yeah, that doesn't. It doesn't. Jeremiah says, if you don't surrender, you're going to die. If you don't surrender, you're going to die. Go surrender. Again, that's not going to like fill you up with strength. Yes, we're confident. Yeah, we're going to win. The bravery doesn't work out well that way. But Jeremiah pointed to the king in his private conversations. King, look later on in the next chapter, or tale of 38 to 39. King says, okay, what's going to happen? Jeremiah says, I've been telling you the truth. All your prophets have been lying to you. They all said Nebuchadnezzar would never show up. But look outside your window. He's here. I'm right. They're all wrong. Okay, this is how it's working. This is pretty obvious. So this process is the Jeremiah, much like Joseph, told the truth. And telling the truth made him enemies. Messiah told the truth too. Telling the truth makes you enemies. Not that you're being, but other enemies against you, right? That's the nature. Even though it's your own personal detriment, telling the truth is still an important thing to do, regardless of the enemy that comes, regardless of the consequence that comes. You cannot use a consequence as an excuse to not tell the truth, to hide or conceal it. So we have Jeremiah, we have Joseph, we have Messiah himself. They all do the same thing. They tell the truth, and yet they receive animosity, anger, hatred, and death threats, or in fact, in actual physical real death, in the case of Messiah. Now, in this storyline, obviously Jeremiah gets pulled out and he survives. He's brought back to guardhouse with, as our English Bibles say, with 30 guards to get him out. I don't know who they were all afraid of, but he had a lot of guards there to get him out. Maybe they haven't been eaten. They're all weak. They took 30 of them to hold him out. I don't know a lot of guards to get him out. But this nature of being a truth teller, even though it's going to hurt, that character trait is what God is loving. That's the awesome thing about it. Being a somebody who God can work with, can talk to, can respond to. Not that you have to know everything and can do everything right. That's the point. The point is that honesty, because what God hates, liars. He hates them. Those who don't tell the truth, he hates that. It's not about being perfect. It's about being willing to do what it takes to get the job done and being honest about it, even the consequences. There's a reason, I think, when God pointed out that, hey, verse 17 of Matthew 3, is that, hey, a voice cries out, this is my son, the one I love, who pleases me. Why does he please him so much? Because Jesus was going to go through this difficulty, being his character the way he needed to be, the right person to be, and go through it anyway, regardless of the outcome. That's an impressive character trait. So God isn't loving him because Jesus is a control freak, or Jesus has lots of anger, or he's forceful, or self-indulgent, or manipulation. None of those character traits are human and fleshly. And rather, Jesus has self-discipline, just like Joseph, just like Jeremiah. Jesus has love, just like Joseph and Jeremiah did, kindness, obedience. Honesty, even though it's at your risk of personal destruction, those are the character traits. So when God loves someone, he loves them for specific reasons, the character traits he can work with and be honorable with. When a parent says, I really like this kid because I can work with this kid and this kid can work with me, easier than that one. It's not the parent doesn't love the child too. That's the bad, is that they can interact with one. They can work with one far better than they can the other one. Does that make sense? So our behaviors, our characters, or the nature of who we are does affect God's ability to work with us. And I dare say, loves more those who he can work with versus those who are rebellious, hateful, spiteful, use people.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.